So like so many other films that are on this topic right now that also don't have distribution, including No Other Land last year that won the Oscars. So we are we're having to self-distribute this film in the United States.
Mm. And the response, Noam, to your comedy or your political commentary, you can call it, in among Palestinians and Israelis? Mm-hmm.
The responses have been amazing, really, really amazing. We've been in many, many different countries in front of many different audiences. In Poland, we are huge. in Poland, just really hundreds of young people were lining up after the film to tell me, you know, how much it's hard for them to criticize Israel because of the past. But now when they see me and they hear me, it gives them vocabulary. And then they also went to tell me how all their grandfathers were in the resistance to the Nazis. And I'm like, guys, it doesn't add up that all your grandparents were in the resistance to the Nazis. But it brings out from people really their personal stories. And also, I want to say something really, really important.
Very quickly, 20 seconds.
This film gives people a vocabulary and an inspiration for better actions and better conversations. And most importantly, you don't need to hear these things from an Israeli. Palestinians are the most reliable sources, just like we heard from the journalist from Gaza, Muhammad, a few moments ago. And so I really hope that people walk out laughing,
crying,
and acting.
We have to leave it there. I thank you so much, Israeli comedian and activist Noam Eliassi. And I also want to thank Amber Ferris, IFC.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are stressed, worried, or just feeling down when they call or text 988. Support is confidential, and call takers are real people in Oregon who speak with understanding and respect. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, legal battles over troop deployment to Portland continue.
The Fed cuts interest rates for the second time this year.
And in international news, while weaker, Hurricane Melissa is still pummeling a number of Caribbean countries.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 29th, 2025. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Josh Salem. The saga involving potential National Guard troop deployment in Portland continues. A federal trial that could determine whether Donald Trump's plans are legal started today. U.S. District Court Judge Karen Immergut, who originally blocked any federal troop deployment here, is presiding over the three-day case. Immergut is assessing whether the Trump administration followed the statute that details what a president can federalize the National Guard, and what the U.S. Constitution says about his authority to deploy members of the Guard. Some claim efforts in Portland have infringed on the state's rights. Trump said the deployment was necessary to protect the U.S. ICE building in South Waterfront, which has been the site of mild protests throughout the summer. In late September, Trump officially federalized 200 members of the Oregon National Guard, but the city of Portland and the Oregon Department of Justice sued to stop the deployment. A trial memo filed this week said, quote, "The president's determination was amply justified by the facts on the ground. It described alleged assault on federal officers and claimed local authorities have been unhelpful and even hostile." Officials also pointed to a three-week closure this summer at the ICE facility as evidence of the inability to carry out federal law, but local reports demonstrated immigration arrests barely slowed. The city of Portland, along with the states of Oregon and California, who all have sued to block the deployment, is arguing the facts on the ground do not meet the legal threshold for the president to federalize and deploy the Guard. The trial memo said, quote, "First Amendment-protected assemblies, even when combined with limited sporadic episodes of unlawful conduct, do not constitute a rebellion or an inability to execute the laws of the United States," end quote. In fact, the Trump administration has walked back a key figure in its arguments. The numbers of Federal Protective Service agents deployed to Portland is much lower than claimed. The trial should last for 3 days. Witnesses expected to testify include members of the Portland Police Bureau and officials from the Department of Homeland Security and the military.
Last week, ICE reportedly detained a parent about 100 feet from Eastwood Elementary School in Hillsboro shortly after drop-off. Since then, teachers, staff, and other volunteers have been patrolling the area around the school before and after the school day, looking for potential ICE agents. Eastwood principal Jose Berzera said in an email to students' families, quote, "While we will not be able to communicate every time there is an ICE activity, we did want to take this opportunity to acknowledge the fear and uncertainty of many of you are feeling and remind you that our school is a safe and welcoming space for all," end quote. 75% of the students at Eastwood are Hispanic or Latinx, as are 45% of the students at nearby J.W. Poynter Middle School. While ICE policy once barred agents from operating in certain sensitive locations, including schools, the agency abandoned that policy earlier this year.
Rural leaders are pushing for FEMA changes. Blue states sue the USDA over SNAP. And vaccine exemption laws are spreading fast. With those stories and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We went through this disaster, and luckily some of the vendors that we utilized getting extra funds up front. We only have a budget of about $8 million. The FEMA Act will definitely be beneficial to rural areas.
Telfair County Commissioner Dakia Bradshaw says rural Georgia is still recovering from last year's Hurricane Helene and warns that Congress should act as another devastating storm plows through the Caribbean. Bradshaw is one of a group of local officials lobbying for the bipartisan FEMA Act now in the House. It would replace the agency's slow reimbursement system with direct grants giving small counties faster access to aid. Democratic states are suing the USDA to force the release of $5.5 billion in emergency food aid as the government shutdown stops SNAP benefits for more than 40 million. They're arguing the White House is unlawfully withholding the money. An increasing number of state lawmakers are challenging what had been standard public health guidance on vaccines. ProPublica reporter Audrey Dutton says the recently passed Idaho Medical Freedom Act makes it illegal for schools, businesses, or even local governments to require vaccines. She says it's being promoted as a national model.
The Health Freedom Defense Fund created a toolkit for activists in other states to talk with their legislators. It's got talking points to get this law out into other states.
The law has drawn praise from Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who calls Idaho the home of medical freedom. President Donald Trump says he's prepared to send, quote, more than the National Guard to cities to crack down on crime and migrants. Meanwhile, a federal judge is criticizing immigration officials for their use of force and tear gas in Chicago. Kentucky community groups are providing migrant services stopped by the federal government. Jim Bennett with the Centro de San Juan Diego in Lexington says their volunteers give medical care, counseling, food, and English classes to thousands of immigrant and refugee families a year.
It's everything from stress, depression, suicidal thoughts, domestic violence and abuse, sexual abuse, marital problems.
In Ohio, a new model for child welfare is showing results. Melanie Allen of Sandusky County Job and Family Services says their specialized foster homes for kids with complex needs help children stay near home rather than sending them to distant institutions.
By licensing our own treatment foster homes, we were able to keep kids closer to home, avoid separating siblings, reduce caseworker travel, and reunify children with their parents more quickly. Yes, we saved money, but even more importantly, we avoided additional trauma for these kids and the long-term negative consequences of that trauma.
An Ohio University study finds the program delivers $4 in returns for every dollar invested. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
The Federal Reserve cut its key interest rate today for the second time this year, even as inflation rates stay high. The decision brings the Fed key rate down to about 3.9% from about 4.1%. The central bank had previously upped its rate to roughly 5.3% in 2023 and 2024 to combat the biggest inflation spike in four decades. Lower rates could be theoretically reduced borrowing costs for mortgages, auto loans, and credit cards, as well as for business loans. The move comes at a difficult time for the central bank. Inflation is stuck about the Fed's 2% target, but the agency is navigating without the economic data it typically relies on from the government, including monthly reports on jobs, inflation, and consumer spending, which have all been suspended because of the government shutdown. The Fed had signaled it may reduce its key rate again in December, but the data drought raises even more uncertainty around its next moves. The Fed typically raises its short-term rate to combat inflation, while it cuts rates to encourage borrowing and spending, and to boost hiring. Its two goals are in conflict, so it seems to want to support the job market while still keeping rates high enough to avoid stimulating the economy so much that it worsens inflation. Trump has repeatedly attacked the Fed chair for not reducing borrowing costs more quickly. He repeated his criticisms today. Trump said, quote, he's out of here in another couple of months. Powell's term ends in May. The administration is apparently considering five people to replace him. Powell was asked about the impact of the government shutdown. He said the agency still has access to some data that might offer a signal. September's job report, scheduled to be released 3 weeks ago, is still postponed, and the White House said last week that October's inflation report may never be issued at all.
J.D. Vance said late yesterday that he believes U.S. military members will be paid at the end of the week. He did not specify how the Trump administration will reconfigure monies needed because of what is now the second longest government shutdown in history. Funding battles have heated up this week as millions of Americans face the prospect of losing food assistance through SNAP. Many more federal workers missed their first full paycheck, and monumental delays at airports continue to pile up. Vance said, quote, we do think that we can continue paying the troops, at least for now. We're trying to keep as much open as possible. We just need the Democrats to actually help us out, end quote. The vice president apparently agrees with the Republican strategy of trying to gather a handful of Senate Democrats to vote for stopgap funding to reopen the government. However, right before Vance's statements, a Senate vote on legislation to do just that failed for the 13th time. Earlier in the week, the nation's largest federal employee union, the American Federation of Federal Employees, called on Congress to immediately pass a funding bill and ensure workers receive full pay. That union is said to carry considerable political weight with Democratic lawmakers. Democratic senators have insisted on commitments from Trump that the administration will not pursue mass firing of more federal workers. In addition, the push for Congress to extend subsidies for health plans under the Affordable Care Act remains central to opposition. 1.3 million active duty service members are at risk of missing their paycheck on Friday. Earlier this month, the administration ensured they were paid by shifting $8 billion from military research and development funds to make payroll. But Trump has rejected the use of more than $5 billion in contingency funds to keep SNAP benefits going into November. And the administration says states will not be reimbursed if they temporarily cover the cost of benefits next month. A coalition of 25 states and the District of Columbia filed a lawsuit yesterday trying to compel the Agriculture Department to use the SNAP contingency funds. The department says the contingency fund is intended to help respond to emergencies, such as natural disasters. Republicans insist they will not entertain negotiations on health care until the government reopens.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO's News in Depth. We'll be talking with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots about the article highlighting the helpers. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Then at 8, it's Ditch Digger. Tonight's weather will show a few passing clouds with a low of 43. Tomorrow's weather will have morning fog, with some cloudiness in the afternoon. The high will be 59. Today in history, in 1929, the New York Stock Exchange crashed, ending the great bull market of the 1920s and ushering in the Great Depression. The quote of the day is from Woody Herman, the American band leader who died on this day in 1987. Herman said, "We might as well swing, boys, because Stravinsky cuts us all."
Hurricane Melissa raced across Cuba today, causing hundreds of thousands of residents to be evacuated to shelters, even though it has now been downgraded to a Category 1 storm. Previously, Melissa devastated Jamaica after being labeled one of the strongest Atlantic hurricanes on record. It caused power outages, fallen trees, landslides, building damage, and heavy flooding. Melissa has been moving north-northeast at 14 miles per hour, and the National Hurricane Center warned that preparations for the storm in the Bahamas, quote, should be rushed to completion. Melissa was a Category 5 hurricane, the highest level, when it made landfall yesterday in Jamaica. It was the strongest storm to hit the island since record-keeping began 174 years ago. The Hurricane Center also warned that catastrophic flash flooding and landslides are possible in Cuba and Hispaniola, the island which Haiti and the Dominican Republic share. The rapid strengthening appears to be linked to climate change. Scientists have warned warming ocean temperatures to hurricanes will cause intensifying more quickly. Abnormally warm ocean waters of about 4 or 5 degrees Fahrenheit above normal were felt to double Hurricane Melissa's wind speed in less than 24 hours. Melissa is the fourth storm in the Atlantic this year to undergo rapid intensification.
A new report from Oxfam International shows that a person from the richest 0.1% produces more carbon pollution in a day than the poorest 50% emit all year. Entitled Climate Plunder: How a Powerful Few Are Locking the World into Distaste, the report presents extensive updated data and analysis, which finds that if everyone emitted like the richest 0.1%, the world's carbon budget would be used up in less than 3 weeks. The super rich are not just over-consuming carbon, but are also actively investing in profiting from the corporations polluting the most. Almost 60% of billionaire investments are in high climate impact sectors, such as oil or mining. Amit Abahar, executive director of Oxfam, said, quote, "The climate crisis is an inequity crisis. The very richest individuals in the world are funding and profiting from climate destruction, leaving the global majority to bear the fatal consequences of their unchecked power," end quote. The admissions of the investment portfolios of just 308 billionaires total more than the combined emissions of 118 countries worldwide.
A law from a neighboring state makes it illegal for governments, businesses, and schools to require vaccines. Now, that legislation might become a model for the entire United States. With more on the story, here's Eric Tegetoff.
Idaho lawmakers passed legislation this year that makes it illegal to require vaccines. The law could become a model for anti-vaccine policies across the country. The Idaho Medical Freedom Act, passed in April, makes it illegal for state and local governments, businesses, and schools to require vaccinations or any other medical intervention. That's despite near total consensus among public health officials and decades of research that vaccines are effective and save lives. Audrey Dutton with ProPublica reported on the network of activists who helped write and pass the law, including Leslie Manoukian, the founder of the Health Freedom Defense Fund.
The Health Freedom Defense Fund created a toolkit for activists in other states to talk with their legislators. It's got talking points. And Leslie's goal is to get this law that she created out into other states.
Dutton notes that the law doesn't change much for Idaho, where it was already easy to bypass vaccine mandates. But Idaho's law has gained widespread recognition, including from U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who visited Manoukian in Idaho last summer and called the state the home of medical freedom. A Louisiana lawmaker introduced the Louisiana Medical Freedom Act on the day the Idaho Medical Freedom Act was signed into law. Dutton also spoke with Mary Holland, head of the Children's Health Defense Fund, which RFK Jr. chaired before joining the Trump administration.
She said, well, parents in California and New York have had to create these private associations where they can educate their children without having to have vaccines. They could certainly do that in Idaho, too, but do it for parents who want their child to be in a school that has vaccines.
However, Dutton notes that parents couldn't technically create a school that legally requires vaccines because that would be illegal under the Idaho Medical Freedom Act. She says the debate over vaccines has raised interesting philosophical questions, including the freedom to choose which medical treatments you get.
That's where the divisions lie between you get to choose what happens to your body. Does it affect other people, though? I think that that's just so fascinating, and I hope that people around the country are thinking about that.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
There has been an explosion in the number of HIV cases in Maine. The underlying reasons might predict for a similar problem about to take place throughout the rest of the United States. With that story and more, here's Catherine Carl.
Public health experts in Maine warn the defunding of federal harm reduction programs could spark disease outbreaks and a rise in overdose deaths. According to reporting from KFF Health News, the clearing of a Bangor homeless encampment earlier this year and the closure of a syringe distribution program may have contributed to an outbreak of HIV. Jennifer Gunderman, director of public health and community services in Bangor, says needle exchange sites offer those struggling with addiction a chance to get tested or even get into recovery.
It's that moment where someone is having a connection with another person who says, I'm here. If you want information on resources, I can help you to do that.
According to the CDC, participants in needle exchanges are 5 times more likely to enter drug treatment programs. But a recent executive order from President Donald Trump links harm reduction programs to crime in general, despite a lack of evidence. Advocates worry further backlash could force more programs to shutter. The executive order also calls for removing homeless people from the streets and involuntarily committing them to treatment facilities. In February, Bangor officials closed a homeless encampment of nearly 100 residents, which had existed for several years. Amy Clark with the Bangor Area Recovery Network says that was a mistake. She says health workers no longer know where to find the newly diagnosed or those who want to get well.
The only thing that keeps somebody from recovering, the only way that somebody is a lost cause is if they die. And so how do we keep them alive long enough to be at the place where they want to seek treatment or are able to seek treatment and are able to better their lives?
She says advocates were able to keep track of at least a third of encampment residents, helping remind some people of their medical appointments or prescriptions. City officials say they took a humane approach, ramping up services for months prior to the clearing. The city is now using more than $500,000 in opioid settlement funds to hire more case managers after an HIV program serving 5 northern counties was forced to close. This story was produced with original reporting from Aniri Patani for KFF Health News. I'm Catherine Carley for Maine News Service.
Washington State will give food banks $2.2 million per week to help allay the effect of the pending shutdown of Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits beginning Saturday. Washington Governor Bob Ferguson just directed the State Department of Social and Health Services to transfer the money to the state's Department of Agriculture for grants to food banks. In May, the most recent month for which federal data are available, over 905,000 Washingtonians received a total of $167 million in SNAP benefits. Democratic attorneys general and governors across the country, including Washington's Nick Brown, sued the Trump administration yesterday over its refusal to continue providing SNAP payments. Despite holding billions of dollars in reserve, the Trump administration says it can't fund SNAP.
Many indigenous people number among the many Americans about to lose SNAP benefits. Tribal members have been signing up for the program, even though, or perhaps because it might go away soon. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Thousands of Native people across the Mountain West are among those who will lose Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, food benefits if the federal government shutdown continues. The Mountain West News Bureau's Daniel Spalding reports tribal officials are concerned about cuts to programs that were already stretched thin.
SNAP will run out of money on November 1st if the shutdown continues. And nearly a quarter of Indigenous households use SNAP benefits, double the national rate. Julie Keller leads food services at Nez Mipu Health on the Nez Perce Reservation in Idaho.
Feeding families is very expensive, and people are struggling to make ends meet. And these programs help people provide basic nutrition for their whole family.
Keller says more tribal members have been signing up to receive food benefits out of fear that they may soon be canceled. Five states in the Mountain West have issued warnings for SNAP recipients. Some states, like Colorado, are providing emergency funding for alternate food sources. Meanwhile, a group of Democratic leaders in several states are suing the federal government over the suspension of benefits. I'm Daniel Spaulding.
The Cherokee Nation declared a food emergency Tuesday due to the federal government shutdown in response to the expected loss of SNAP benefits. The Oklahoma tribe is making more than $6 million in emergency relief funding available. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. explained the tribe's response in a social media post, saying they'll protect those most at risk of hunger.
We will not turn our backs on people in need as the federal government remains gridlocked. Our response may not be perfect, but we will not stand back and watch people suffer.
Other tribes across the country have also declared an emergency due to the federal government shutdown. The Western disaster relief effort has moved to its next phase. Earlier this month, hurricane-force winds and floods forced more than 1,000 people from their homes. Many families were sent to mass shelters in Anchorage. This week, the city has begun to transition them into temporary housing. KMBA's Rhonda McBride visited the Egan Convention Center downtown, where families are preparing to move on.
Little boys and girls are sad. They're homesick.
Tessie Chanarak is one of the counselors from South Central Foundation, watching out for families at the Egan Center. She says counselors have been keeping kids occupied with games, and it's helped that Halloween is around the corner.
You know, Halloween is one of the fun seasons of the year because lots of candy. We got some costumes and we've got some hats and trick-or-treating bags. So anything for the little kids too. So they seem to be more at home than their parents.
Chanarak says at first, when families moved into the shelter, the reality of what they had escaped had not yet sunk in. She saw families look at videos and photos captured on their cell phones over and over, as if to try to understand what they had experienced.
Can't believe the typhoon kicked in. I can't believe our homes floated away. It's like, that really happened. And yesterday, when I was checking with folks, they're crying. They're tired.
Despite that, Chanarek says families have held up remarkably well. But she's glad they'll soon be transferred to temporary housing so they can begin their recovery. She says she's grateful for the elders because they've been a calming influence on everyone.
I really do admire that. That gives me a tool that I can use, taking it one day at a time.
Chanarak wears a pair of angel wings that came from a Halloween costume, known to the kids as Terrific Tessie. She's originally from Tuksuk Bay, one of the communities also in the storm's path. She says she feels honored to be of help as both a counselor and a speaker of the Yupik language. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Chicagoans are turning waste into usable power. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Community advocates on the south side of Chicago are transforming 9 acres of abandoned, once polluted land into the Green Era campus, a hub for urban agriculture and renewable energy. Erica Allen is co-founder of Green Era Sustainability and CEO of the Urban Growers Collective, both of which are project partners.
Our campus approach is to sort of learn, teach, demonstrate, and generate capital to really be successful financially without extracting from people or the environment.
This year, the group cut the ribbon on its first major project, a large anaerobic biodigester. The system takes food waste that would otherwise decompose in landfills and emit climate-warming gases to the atmosphere. As it breaks that food down, the biodigester captures those gases instead: carbon dioxide for use in the concrete and beverage industries, and methane that's sold as renewable natural gas. In the process, the system also produces fertilizer that helps community gardens grow healthy local food.
And then there's the social dimension, of course, that our young people are growing up with this kind of innovative tech and this approach in their backyard, as opposed to it being somewhere else.
So this investment in green technology is also an investment in the community's future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is not ready for a Republican winter.
Winter's coming. Are you ready? Do you have a roof, walls, and heat? And not just where you live, but for your emotional and spiritual well-being, shelter from the winds of inflation, the downpours of national news, the chills of isolation, as the darkness that's amassing has little to do with the season. A month from now, will we look back at 2025 and give thanks for what we and others have done to make sure spring returns, and not just for the wealthy? Our current Grinch isn't green, but orange, and more heartless than Dr. Seuss could have imagined. Will Donnie even wait till Christmas to unwrap the next war, be it in South America, Asia, or the West Coast? But first comes Halloween, when we can disguise ourselves and safely release some of the fear that's been building, and Dia de los Muertos, when we can remember love and good deeds from the past, renew our commitment to honor those expressions, and work for better times as soon as possible. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 29th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael. The producer is myself, Josh Salem, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Farah Siddiqui, Eric Tegetoff, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland.